This evening's speaker is Margaret Gaynor. Margaret began Buddhist meditation practice in 1995 after taking Jon Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction class. Since then, she has practiced weekly with the San Jose Insight Meditation and attended events at IMC. In 2005, she began teaching a weekly meditation class for women inmates at Elmwood Correctional Facility in Milpitas. Through Sati Center, she has completed the Buddhist chaplaincy training. Margaret is a member of the First Congregational Church of San Jose and brings together Buddhist and Christian teachings there. She has taught at San Jose Insight Meditation and Insight Meditation South Bay.
Thank you very much, and welcome to all of you once again. I chose for my topic tonight faith, and if you have any experience in Buddhist practice, faith is maybe an odd topic to choose because Buddhist practice is so empirical. But I just wanted to add one little bit about my biography. I began meditation because it was prescribed by my doctor. I was sent to the El Camino Jon Kabat-Zinn program because of a heart arrhythmia 12 years ago. And it was just enough to get me hooked, and I haven't stopped since. And the heart problem went away, and they couldn't explain that one either. So I've told my doctor I consider him my first Buddhist teacher. He was the one who arranged to have the program in the hospital and just refers patients there on an as-need basis. And I suggest if you know people who have medical problems that are a little intractable, it's a good program. You can learn a lot there. And I got a sense at that program there was more to it than just what they were teaching me. And the suggestion was to pursue meditation further, if you felt that way, through meditation groups like this. So that's what I did, and that's how I got here 12 years later. So my topic tonight is faith. My early experience around faith might have been, you might have had the experience too, where faith was a doctrine that was taught to me by family, by teachers, and faith sort of equaled belief. And if you didn't believe it, you kept your mouth shut, or you felt separated from people. Whatever they were telling me, I simply accepted as truth when I was a child. So maybe 45 years later, when I walked into this mindfulness-based stress reduction class, which is based on Buddhist principles, the very first thing I saw written on the whiteboard, and if I had a whiteboard here, I would have written it down so you could see it first too, was faith as trust, faith as confidence. And I thought, whoa, that's a new take for me. I had not heard faith expressed in that way. And it really caught my attention and made me a little more interested in the program than maybe I started out to be. So I would like to take a minute and ask you if you have any experiences, whether in your childhood or from teachers or parents, that you'd be interested in saying a few sentences about what faith has meant to you. And, you know, I'm not talking necessarily about religious faith. I'm talking about whatever you think faith means. Any responses to that?
For me, if I'm going through a difficult period of time, and I've gone through many difficult periods of time, kind of having a faith that everything is the way it should be or everything works out, you know, like there's a saying, like no snowflake ever falls in the wrong place. Kind of having faith in that has really helped me get through a lot of hard times.
Thank you. Any other observations? Well, my guess is many of us, I'm speaking for myself, were raised in a religious home where faith was simply told to you, and that was what you believed for a long time. That was my experience of faith. And it resulted in my sort of walking away from that kind of faith when I became a young adult and not going back again. So seeing the observation on the whiteboard, faith as trust, really was like a shift of the compass for me. It was an important understanding. There's a story in the Buddhist suttas about the Kalamas, who were a group of people in India. It's a very classic story about what the Buddha says that you need to believe in or trust in. And the Kalamas were a group of people, remembering that in India at the time of the Buddha, maybe about 500 years before Christ, how do they say it, BCE? Is that the correct designation now? There were many teachers, like the Buddha, spiritual teachers, walking around the countryside, teaching this, teaching that, to the point where the group of people, Kalamas, were totally confused about what was true. And they were feeling pulled this way by one teacher and that way by another teacher. So when the Buddha came to the village, they came to him together and said, "Please tell us, how do we decide what the truth is with all these different views coming at us?" So here's what the Buddha said, and this is a really classic sutta. The Buddha said, "It is proper that you have doubt, that you have perplexity. Now look you, Kalamas, do not be led by reports or tradition or hearsay. Be not led by the authority of religious texts, nor by mere logic, nor by inference, nor by appearances, nor by delight in speculative opinions, nor by possibilities, nor by the idea, this is our teacher. But, Kalamas, when you know for yourselves that certain things are unwholesome and wrong and bad, give them up. And when you know for yourselves that certain things are wholesome and good, then accept them and follow them." So what authority was he offering? Your own authority. Not the teacher, not the scripture, not logic, not speculative opinions, not appearances. I have attended teachings by the Dalai Lama where he'll teach for 4 or 5 days at a time, very scholarly, really kind of dry teaching. But in the introduction to these classes, he always says, no matter what you hear from me or my translator or what your friends talk about after I'm through talking, check here. And he put his fingers and indicated his heart. Check here for the truth. And in Eastern traditions, the heart and the mind are together. They're not separated the way we have it in the West. So heart and mind are what we rely on for discovering for ourselves what we can trust and what the truth is for us. So that's where we start an investigation about faith. Faith as a quality of trust and confidence is well-founded when it gives us ease in the midst of dis-ease or unease, when it gives us comfort in the midst of discomfort, purpose in the midst of fear, or steadiness in the midst of chaos. So I'm not saying, and I don't think you'll find a teacher who will tell you, all your discomforts will go away, your fears will go away, and chaos will go out of your life. That's probably not going to happen. As humans, we have messy relationships, we have decaying bodies, we have complicated lives. But with a well-founded faith, a trust, we can be present with these aspects of our lives as well, with the easy and the difficult, with the pleasant and the unpleasant. You may have noticed during your meditation tonight, it was pleasant when it was quiet. It was unpleasant when the motorcycles go by, or whatever it was for you. We all have these aspects to our lives. When we learn to trust our ability to be present with everything, we don't add suffering to our life by clinging to what we want to keep, by hating what we don't want, or by deluding ourselves about what's really true. When we have this kind of well-founded trust, we allow things to be just as they are in the moment, trusting ourselves to see them clearly and trusting that we will know what to do in the present moment. So with this kind of trust, well-founded trust, you don't have to know everything ahead of time. You don't have to have every single issue in your life planned out. You learn to be in the moment with what we call don't know mind, or beginner's mind. The kind of mind that looks at a problem and sees simply what it is, without adding a lot of baggage to it from our own fears and our own preconceptions. I have a husband who has this engineering mind, and it's very much this kind of beginner's mind. He's not a Buddhist. This is not a story about Buddhist practice. But if I break something or if I observe something is broken, I immediately decide what's wrong with it and try to fix that particular aspect of it, which often doesn't work. So I end up bringing it to him, abjecting myself to his engineer's brain and saying I couldn't fix it. So all he wants to know is not my theories about what's wrong. He wants to know the symptom. Well, on the telephone, the bell won't ring. So I go in. It's a short in the switch. It's a this. It's a that. So he simply looks at the telephone and he says, okay, the bell didn't ring. And he turns the switch to on. Well, it never occurred to me to look at the switch on or off because I had a preconceived notion of how things should be. And he didn't. He heard the symptom. He heard the problem. And he started with beginner's mind to work through the problem. So I always kind of turn to that when I see myself doing these things with my mind of perceiving how things ought to be and realizing how limiting that is in what could be. So there's a Buddhist teacher whose name is Sharon Salzberg. She has some books out and has written about faith. She describes four stages in the development of faith. I'm going to talk about each one separately, but I'll just tell you what they are tonight, right now. Initial faith, bright faith, verified faith, and abiding faith. Four stages. So if you are very new coming to meditation practice, you may have initial faith. Simple interest in what's going on here. What is this meditation stuff? Is that all the Buddha taught? What else can I learn here? So with initial faith, you trust your ability to know if this is a safe place for you. You trust your ability to know if you might want to continue learning about this, or your ability to know if you don't really need to continue. So it's just enough of a trust in yourself to get yourself to where you need to be to continue learning what you need to learn. So you could say, I trust the interest that brought me here tonight. In that first class I ever attended, the one at the hospital, that was the kind of interest I brought to it. I also brought a certain amount of skepticism, I have to say. I wasn't sure what this was going to be about. And in fact, I was ready to bolt if it got too weird for me, or at least not come back again. And as it turned out, I never heard anything that made me feel that way. And in fact, the teaching was wonderful, and it made me feel the opposite way, that I did want to continue learning. So I stuck with it, and I still stick with it. Now, if you recently began to learn about these teachings of compassion and wisdom, and they've begun to have some effect in your life, you may have what is called bright faith. With bright faith, you have a time of excitement, of new realizations about yourself, about the world. You understand yourself more deeply. You see the possibilities for transformation. You find the teachings inspiring, the teachers inspiring, and you feel uplifted. This is bright faith. You could say, I trust what I'm learning about the Buddha's teachings and find joy and excitement learning about them. Bright faith is like being in love, that exciting time, full of joy. It just carries us along. I remember being in that state after that initial 8-week class in the hospital when I began to attend teachings regularly. And I thought it was just wonderful. And it was just wonderful. I did get lots of realizations about myself. The teachers just came and offered this wonderful wisdom. And every week I could learn something new. It was so uplifting. And I got into the habit of enthusiasm where I would tell everybody who had no interest at all in Buddhist teachings, I would tell everybody what I had learned the night before in the meditation group at the Sangha. And I'm sure some people got very bored hearing about it. And I know I passed a lot of misinformation along because I was too new. I just really didn't get all these profound concepts that were being taught. But I was excited by it, and I couldn't stop it from bubbling out. However, bright faith is not reliable. It's that excitement that is emotional, and emotions have the character of rising and passing. They flow along and change. And when they go, then you begin to question, wait a minute, Is this still the same thing I used to be so excited about? You know, it's feeling a little routine. The teacher I thought was so great made a few mistakes or behaved in a way I think wasn't quite right. You begin to have a few questions about things. And instead of having that excitement, you have uncertainty. You have wondering whether you're in the right place anymore. At that point, you begin to shift, at least for me, this was my experience, shift from trusting the feelings of excitement and turning to my experience of the teachings. Did they work for me? Yes. Do they still work for me? Checking heart and mind. Yes, no harm is being caused by these teachings. The teachers I choose now as good teachers, are they still useful for me? Yes, checking heart and mind, those teachers are useful. So the faith and the trust maybe turns away from that excitement and goes, the teachings are trustworthy, the teachers are trustworthy. That's what I can rely on in this period when I don't feel so certain that I know everything about it, that I feel a little routine and not excited anymore. So, of course, you always trust your ability to ask these questions, to study, to investigate, to inquire, and to continually check with heart and mind. As you move on, both with Buddhist practice and with other important aspects of your life, you may come to a verified faith about this practice or about this aspect of your life. A verified faith is when you can see your own ability to understand these teachings, to use them skillfully, to find good teachers, and to let go of things being the way you want them to be, so that you can be with difficulty, with happiness, and with neutral states in just the same way. You discover with verified faith that you are bringing less suffering into your life and into the lives of others. You could say, I trust my ability to be of benefit to myself and to others. One thing verified faith can really show you when you trust that ability to question and look and use these practices is habits, the patterns of habit that our lives are so made up with. In my little intro, you heard that I teach at Elmwood Jail. I was invited to teach at Elmwood Jail by Brigitte Jelaine, who, if you've been coming, you may know, already had a class teaching women inmates. They wanted to open another class, and she called me and said, how would you like to teach that class? And I said, no way, me? This huge fear, which is a pattern of my life. Fear has been a really kind of formative thing for me. This huge fear arose. Me, you know. I said to her, I said, I don't have your background in therapy. I don't have your background in teaching these practices, and I'm afraid to go into jail. So thanks for asking, but no thanks. And, you know, I decided that I was going to question that reaction. Why was I so afraid around this? What was that fear? And a lot of that fear was exactly the fears I expressed. I don't have her background as a counselor. I didn't have any background teaching and teaching the Dharma practice. And I was afraid to go to jail. That is all true. The underlying fear of that was sort of an ego fear. What if I mess up? What if I don't look so good? People in jail are hard to be with. What if I can't do it? You know, how would I look? A big ego fear. Underlying ego fear, you know, you can peel these habits like an onion. What's under ego fear? Maybe a fear of not existing. That really primal fear of, if I don't perform well, who will I be? You know. And when you realize, well, maybe the self isn't as important as I thought anyway, coming down to that primal fear and realizing that I had some skills to bring to this, I sort of came back up again. I taught third grade for a while. Perfect experience for teaching in jail where there's short attention span, easy distractions. Perfect experience. I've taught all my life. I didn't have and don't have her experience as a counselor, but I've lived for 62 years. You know, I've had a lot of experiences with a lot of different people. And I have some insights into that. And I thought, yeah, you know, I could probably handle that. Was I afraid to go in jail? Yeah, I was afraid. So talked it over with my husband, meditated with it, really felt what this fear felt like, and decided, in spite of the pattern of this fear coming up and grabbing my life and saying, you cannot do this, I said, that's the pattern. My reflection tells me I want to try to do this. And underlying that reflection of try to do it was the feeling, I could do a good job at this. But I couldn't say that. That ego was still there, not letting me say it. So I called her up and said, I'll give it a try. And I've been going for a couple of years, and I think I do a good job. And I love going there. Many times it's difficult to go there, and many times it's difficult to teach there. But I like it. It's challenging. I like the challenge, and I have learned that I don't have to not do something because I'm afraid of it. That I can be present with the fear and do what I choose to do anyway. So this is the kind of thing that happens with a serious practice when you come to a state of what Sharon Salzberg calls abiding faith, unwavering faith, unshakable faith. She describes this quality as a lived understanding that draws us to realize our ideals, walk our talk, and act in accord with what we know to be true, in spite of fear. Paul Tillich, who was a theologian, calls this kind of faith alignment with our ultimate concern, with whatever is the centering point for our life. And this centering point does not have to be Buddhism. It could be loving our neighbor. If you're theistic, it could be remembering God. The centering point for your life could be a principle, such as justice, the truth of nature, of reality. Or the centering point could be an aspiration, such as freedom from suffering, or the benefit of all beings. With abiding faith, with well-founded abiding faith, we trust our ability to meet experience without these patterns taking us over. You see the habit kick in. I don't think we ever actually lose the habits, but you choose to let go of that automatic reaction that habit brings. You see an appropriate response instead. So if you have an abiding faith, you could say, I trust my ability to align my life with my deepest concerns. So with this faith, we have a willingness to be vulnerable, to not know, to actually live in that beginner's mind and to rest in trust. My experience of working outside of habitual patterns actually continues to confirm this kind of what I call abiding faith. About 4 months ago, a young friend of mine, only in her 30s, began to die of cancer and didn't have family. And had wonderful friends of her own age, but no one the age of a parent for her. And I chose to step in and not be her parent, but to be an older woman in her life at the end of her life. I've never done that before. I've had people in my own family who died, but I did not have this practice of consciousness when that happened. So I simply coped blindly as well as I could. But with this young woman, and also with the training that I received in chaplaincy class, I chose to step in a different way, to be very conscious of my own reactions to what was happening, my fears, my angers sometimes. Anything can come up. When someone dies, it's totally unpredictable. And I felt every day going into the hospital not having a clue how it would be. If I would be grieving, if I would be frustrated trying to calm her, if I would be trying to help her friends to be able to go in and say goodbye in some way that they had no idea how to do. Would I be able to do that? So these are the situations that I was able to work in. And teaching in jail is the same thing. Every week you go, you have no idea how it's going to be. The women change every week. There may be the same ones in for a few weeks, and there may be different ones. There may be defiant ones. There may be quiet ones, there may be sick ones, anything can happen. And mostly it's a lot of fun and very challenging. And some weeks the questions come up, why do I come here? And the answer is because my intention is to come here, to be present for these women, and to model for them what it means to be patient, what it means to be accepting, even in the face of defiance and trouble sometimes. So, but, you know, mostly it's a lot of fun to go there. They like it that I come. They appreciate my presence. And they learn this practice. And they're not always polite about it. If they're bored, you can see they're bored. They act bored. They look out the window. They write notes. They're good trainers for teachers, I'm telling you, because you see right away what works and what doesn't. But it's abiding faith that I never could have done that practice nor this practice around death without having come through these stages to that. So the evolution of faith is another part of the story. When we begin in this practice or in anything else that's an important practice for us, at first we feel uneasy and inadequate about believing in ourselves. And then the realization comes with some thinking that originally, basically, there is nothing wrong with you. There is nothing wrong with me. Your awakened heart is there. Right at the moment you feel fear, your awakened heart is still there. It's like not being able to see the sun on a cloudy day. The sun is still there, but you can't see it because of the clouds. The awakened heart is present within each one of us. But we've layered over it with our habits, with our fears, with our preconceptions and all kinds of emotions. So when we realize that, we begin to trust ourselves and we develop faith in this, what we sometimes call Buddha mind or this awakened self. And as we learn some more about these teachings, we develop faith in our ability to become the teachings, to become the embodiment of the teachings. Just as I said, when I go to the jail, I try to be patient so they can see what patience looks like on a person. I try to be compassionate so they can see what that looks like. Is that hard? Some days it's darn near impossible. But I really try to do it. And I get more benefit than they do, I think. It's probably why I go there. I learn so much about myself and watching my own mind states doing that. So we develop a faith in our own ability to be these practices. How? Through meditation and through the ethical practices of the perfections or the Noble Eightfold Path, which is something you might learn about if you stay with this. What are the bases of faith? Well, first of all, yourself. Trust in yourself. Not that a conceited basis, not that I'm special, but that everybody has the possibility of awakening, of liberating themselves from patterns and unconscious thinking and living. I have that ability. I have that possibility also. So we have faith in the insight of our own experience to see what is true. There's always this reference back to our own mind and heart. We learn to trust that. It's difficult when we begin. The questions that might come up are, someone else must know better than I know. I hardly know anything. Or, how can I trust this confused mind? I certainly had questions like that. The other part is we are afraid to look at our shadow, our own shadow. When we sit quietly in meditation, we see the dark sides of ourself come into the light. Things that we don't really want to know about ourselves, our pettiness. Sometimes when I go on retreats that last over several days, it's so interesting. Never fails. The first thing that comes up for me is anger. I don't know if it's anger at the food, anger at the person sitting next to me breathing too loudly. It's amazing. And at first it frightened me. And when it became obvious that it was going to happen every retreat, I realized I must stuff down a lot of anger in my life. And when I finally have sort of quiet, protracted space, it just all comes up. And if you're sitting next to me, you're the focus. Now, I never say it to you, but it just fumes. And I've learned to just be present with it and not become the anger. And to watch how strong it can be with no fuel whatsoever except my own mind. This is the same thing that happens when fear arises. Sometimes when depression arises, when we take it all on ourselves, I'm not talking about a chemical depression, but a sort of conceited depression when we just simply become our sadness. Sharon Salzberg says, when we stop running away from what presents itself in each moment, our loving care for ourselves and one another can flow unimpeded. So trusting ourselves has this possibility of flowing outward to turn into compassion for other people. You connect with them through this compassion. Another really important basis of faith is your own ability to question and investigate. And I'm not talking about the kind of questions our inner critic asks. You know, those questions like, well, who do you think you are to ask that question? Or who does he think he is expounding about the Buddhist practices? Or don't you think it's stupid to sit here and be uncomfortable? This is the inner critic. The inner critic is kind of based on that fear, on not wanting anything to change. Comfort in everything being the same. Is everything going to stay the same in your life? Never. Never. It will never stay the same. But the inner critic is going to work as hard as possible to make that happen. Those are the kinds of questions an inner critic asks to prevent change from coming through. So again, Sharon Salzberg says, learning to question means feeling we have the innate right to do so. It is our right to find out the truth for ourselves. Questioning becomes your lived response to the living questions, the deepest questions we have about birth, about existence, about aging and death. These huge questions, when you sit with someone who's dying and you watch day by day and hour by hour, the physical changes, the mental changes, the emotional changes, some are good and some are not so good. These huge questions arise in your own mind. What will it be like when I die? Why was I born? Why was she born and dies so young and I'm still living? These are big questions. These are the questions we live. We use our power to inquire, to explore, and to see again what is true for ourselves. This means faith in questioning also means not turning from what we discover to be true, even if it's something that we don't like, that we wish were not true. And often that kind of truth is a deep truth about ourselves that we just assume was not true. So trust in the teachings is another basis. The teachings that you learn coming to a group like this, when we put into practice something that actually helps us overcome difficulties or make a transformation in our lives, confidence begins to build. When we experience what it feels like to embody these teachings, and that by doing that, we actually can transform our behavior, we can transform our attitudes, and we can find some peace. Our faith is strengthened further. A really important place in my early faith was faith and trust in the teachers. When I began going to the regular meditation group, three teachers would come in rotation to teach our group. The teacher from this sangha, Gil Fronsdahl, and two other teachers would come. And I was so impressed. They just came and gave this wonderful wisdom. And you could see by the way they answered questions and treated people that they, for me, embodied the practices that I was trying to learn. So in a teacher, we see our own potential for happiness, for wisdom, and for compassion. We may not be there ourselves because we're too new or we're too unskilled. But when we see a teacher who works from those places, we know it is possible to do that, that it might take time and lots of attention, but it is possible. One of the maybe crucial bases for faith, is actually suffering, pain. In Buddhist teaching, suffering is considered a proximate cause for faith. And when I say suffering, I don't necessarily mean sort of gut-busting suffering, although it could be, or huge emotional suffering, although it certainly could be. Sometimes we feel suffering as simply dissatisfaction, unsettledness, unease, a failure to find peace anywhere. The classical term for all these states is suffering. And I like that term because those states to me feel like suffering. And when I'm suffering, that's when the investigation, at least for me, needs to start. Again, the Dalai Lama always says, nobody comes to this practice because they're happy. They come because they're suffering. They're looking for some way to get out of that state, to change. Usually, maybe not usually, but sometimes we want stuff outside of ourselves to change. What we discover in these practices is we can make changes within our own minds, and the same things that used to bring us suffering no longer do. We deal with them differently. And guess what? When you deal differently, sometimes stuff out there has to sort of jockey around too. Lots of changes can happen simply from working with your own mind to discover what you are doing to make things more difficult. So awareness of suffering is actually what caused the Buddha to leave a life of comfort and ease and to go out into a world of searching. And finally, to spend 45 years, his last 45 years, teaching what he discovered after he learned about suffering. He taught people how to deal with suffering in their own lives. So suffering causes us to question and search and not to be satisfied with belief, but to find ways to transform. So we start with the very simplest faith that we can do something. And that's when we begin to question. Deep suffering, deep questioning about suffering can lead to renewal. And I believe this is what leads most people to any kind of spiritual renewal, is being willing to question the suffering that either they feel themselves or that they observe. And we don't have to go looking around and searching for suffering. If you sit in meditation with any regularity, you will find within seconds, possibly, unease arising, dissatisfaction arising, and discomfort arising, mental, emotional, physical. And all you're doing is sitting still like this. In the 20, 15 minutes or so that we did, I bet everybody could have stated what they found uncomfortable, dissatisfying about sitting there. We all felt something. It's part of our experience. So suffering is an important part of faith. There are some obstacles to faith. One, we talked about a bit already, habits. Unthinking patterns of behavior. Habits are based on past conditions. They arise in us when we perform an action and it works at the time. And we do it again and it works. And so it's strengthened. And we do it again and then we don't have to think about it anymore. Every time the situation comes up, we do this action. What happens is the habit pattern is formed, but the action no longer fits the conditions. You know, if, for instance, an abused child will turn into a fantasy world, and that works for a child. They feel protected away from their abuse. When they grow up, they can't live that way anymore. This is what I see in jail so often. So many of these women have been abused as children and turn to drugs as a way to fantasize out of the same kind of abuse that they still are seeing in their minds that has finished now. This is a really extreme example of a habit pattern that affects an adult life and is no longer useful in an adult life and, in fact, brings suffering. When we see that conditions are different, our old habits prevent us from actually even seeing the difference because we don't stop and think. We just, boom, react out of the habit. A habit of anger is very much that way. If we are used to reacting in anger to anything we don't like, we'll be yelling or punching before we stop and think, maybe words could work better. Maybe I could separate myself and come back again. That never occurs to us because the habit has kicked in and we haven't even seen it. So there's no way we can respond appropriately if we haven't even had time to see that there's an appropriate and different way. With trust in ourselves, we begin to see that there is a certain mystery about life that we're never going to be able to plan for. Things are going to come up that surprise us, and we need the ability to respond in the moment. Just as things unfold, not to have a little repertoire of habits built up for every possible situation, but to simply be attentive enough, because we practice that in meditation, being attentive, so that when we need to be attentive in our life, that a skill is there, and we can see right in the moment, ah, there's my habit of fear, but I'm not going to go there. I'm going to stay with this person who's in pain and dying because she feels better when I'm present. Whatever I feel is not going to be a part of my intention right now. My presence is what I intend. That's how I used the breaking through of habit. The Dalai Lama actually calls laziness a problem, and which it is, and that faith is the antidote to laziness. He describes laziness as that kind of psychological inferiority where we simply say, oh, I'm not capable of doing this. I'm inferior. I could not possibly do it. And so we don't attempt it, like sitting in meditation for 40 minutes straight. If we say, I'm not capable of it, do we try? I don't think so. But he suggested that we simply reflect on this awakened nature, this Buddha nature that is within everyone. It's within us too. And the remarkable luck of being a human being in a human body, in a place where you can learn some skills and be taught some skills about how to meditate so that you can wake up. Reflecting on what a good situation you're in can help you deal with that sort of psychological inferiority. Here's another obstacle to faith, and that's belief. And that was what I started with tonight, a belief that is given to you from outside, from another person, or from a tradition, and you just simply accept it. If we cling to something, if we question something and then find a satisfying answer and cling to the answer without continuing the questioning, then that sort of faith becomes a belief rather than what I'm calling trust. A belief is something that clings. Alan Watts, who was the Beat poet, said it. He said, belief clings and faith lets go. So trust and confidence come from continuing discovery, not from grabbing something and never letting go. That's motivated by fear, and that is that's rigid and will never lead to discovery. Once you've found something and have to hang on to it, it's a shield from unpredictability. And I think we all have those points in our life when we don't want anything to be unpredictable, and so we do cling. But I think we also come to a point where we see that limits us, and that's when we need to go back into that self-discovery again. Another obstacle to faith is that faith is the faith that is conditional. If our faith is conditional, then we will only trust or be happy getting what we want in the way that we want it. We have a desire for a particular outcome, and so if something else comes up, whoosh, that's it. No more faith, no more happiness. We are not discovering anything. We're simply rejecting what is true and right in front of us. Another obstacle is certainty. And about certainty, I'm going to read you a little writing from a 16th century Indian poet whose name is Tukaram. And within this poem, the word God is going to be used. If this is a word that is difficult for you, then think the word truth or the word reality or whatever you would like to substitute that would make sense. But here's what Tukaram, who lived in the 16th century, said about certainty. Certainty undermines one's power and turns happiness into a long shot. Certainty confines. Dears, there is nothing in your life that will not change, especially all your ideas of God. Look at what the insanity of righteous knowledge can do. crusade, and maim thousands in wanting to convert that which is already gold into gold. Certainty can become an illness that creates hate and greed. So I think that says it about certainty. So in ending, I think you can probably see that my take on faith, and I think what we are led to call the quality of faith, has as its most important characteristic an openness. Openness that allows questioning, mistakes, wonder, imperfection, discomfort, participation, testing, learning, changing, and growing. Stephen Batchelor is another writer on Buddhist topics. He says, the person who questions lies open and exposed, prepared for the unpredictability of the moment. If we want to be prepared to act with integrity, to act with our truest concern, we have to be willing to drop our desire for things to be as we wish and to trust that we can be true to our deepest self no matter how things turn out. The Pali word for faith, Pali is the language closest to what the Buddha spoke. The Pali word for faith is saddha. And one meaning of that word saddha is hospitality, making room for all experiences, painful and joyful alike. So faith and confidence mean to be open to the mystery of experience, to be open to everything that arises, even if you have no idea of what lies ahead. So I thank you very much for your time and your attention. I could entertain two short questions or one long question, and then we'll finish with a short meditation. Is there, or an observation, if you wish. And if there aren't any, we'll go directly to a meditation.
Probably a long question, I guess. Thank you for your talk. I find it very inspiring because next year I'm going to be moving away from the Bay Area. And I've been thinking lately, what am I going to do? You know, because where I'm going is certainly not going to have an IMC or anything like that. So I've been trying to figure out what am I going to do without the important Buddhist community. And listening to you, I thought, well, maybe I can create it. You know, maybe I can drop into the nearest hospice or jail or whatever and try to start it. And then immediately I started having all those same fears, you know, public speaking or what are they going to think of me? I don't have any credentials. You know, I've never done that. You know, do you recommend, what do you think of that? Do you recommend taking some kind of, like you said, chaplaincy training, or should I just take a leap of faith
Well, I don't know what kind of community you're going to. I can certainly imagine communities without this kind of support for our practice. I think the first thing to do is somehow create a strong practice for yourself by continuing to meditate, by continuing to read, certainly turning to the internet for listening to talks. And I would turn right to IMC, that's your familiar source. I would certainly rely on that as my sort of touchstone of, say, authority, call it authority, myself, teachers that I trust, and writers that I trust. But the practice is lived in the living. And I certainly think that with that as the basis, to go out and do work with hospice. You know, the thing is, there are wonderful people in other faith traditions who work very similarly to the way we work, and you can learn wonderful things from them. If you don't find Buddhist teachers around you, you can still do your Buddhist learning at a distance. But turn to the people who are around you. People in hospitals and hospices are people who care about compassion, who care about being present, who believe that people deserve our attention and time, and I think you might find inspiration there as well. And as far as being a teacher yourself, never think that you aren't. We are each other's teachers, is my feeling. And if you have any training in this practice, you have more than somebody else has. So never think that you can't teach it. You teach in your own example, certainly. But you know more than you think. If you have an interest in it and you begin to feel this kind of trust and faith and confidence, you have what it takes to share that. You might not want to do it on a formal basis at first, but you might. And you might think about that. And I think you should stay open to the moment. You're welcome. And yes, go ahead. I'll take it.
I really appreciated the spirit of your talk with the community here.
I have the sort of basic outline. And you can turn to the web, I believe, and hear it. It won't. I don't know how often. How long does it take for a talk to come up? After a couple of weeks, you'll be able to find it. And I think you'd actually get it better that way, because a lot of what's written, a lot of what I said is not written down. It's kind of, you know, when I'm learning to teach by just kind of coming and teaching. Now, I'm not brave enough to come without some notes, but I find that I can talk from the notes and then add into it. And so I'd be happy to share what I have printed, but I already have notes on it that make it different.
Your chicken scratchings in the margin.
Absolutely. And my mind's chicken scratchings as I was talking. So, but any talk here, I think almost every talk is recorded.
Right.
So if you particularly like one, turn back to it, take notes on it, and just ignore the parts that don't suit you, and take real attention toward the parts that seem to speak to you, because not every teacher will teach what you need, or not every talk will be completely about what you need.
Well, this resonated for me, so thank you.
Sometimes it's like that. I thank you very much. And now I think we need to close with a final meditation. So I will sound the bell to begin it, and then I will give just a very brief guidance as we finish. So please bring yourself into whatever position you have found is going to serve you well to be, after a long talk like this, to kind of sit up and come into some quiet again. Talking and thinking can be very stimulating. But as we start, think about this. Whatever the quality of faith in your life, trust that you are in the place you need to be. Give yourself permission to relax into that place. I trust the interest that has brought me here tonight. I trust what I'm learning about the Buddha's teachings and find joy and excitement in learning about them. I trust my ability to be of benefit to myself and others. I trust my ability to align my life with my deepest concerns. So thank you. Drive safely.